WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. 13 journalists have been murdered in Russia since 1999, when President Vladimir Putin, a former KGB officer, took office. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Michael Spector of The New Yorker, who wrote about the murders in last week's edition of the magazine. Spector says all of the deaths took place under strange circumstances, and none have been successfully investigated or prosecuted. Also, we remember writer, political columnist, and Texas personality Molly Ivins. We'll listen back to two interviews Terry recorded with her. She died in Austin yesterday at the age of 62. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Sacred Games by Vikram Chandra. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Since Vladimir Putin came to power in Russia, a shocking number of his critics and political opponents have been murdered, including prominent journalists, two members of parliament, an executive in Russia's central bank, and former KGB agent in exile Alexander Litvinenko, who died in London after getting a lethal dose of radioactive polonium. British police have completed their investigation into Litvinenko's death and submitted a file to prosecutors. The death of so many of Putin's opponents was the subject of a piece in last week's New Yorker by our guest, journalist Michael Spector. He traces the roots of the killings and their relative toleration among Russians to the country's wrenching transition from communism to a market economy and the lack of a tradition of independent journalism. Michael Spector was the New York Times Moscow bureau chief in the late 90s. He's been a staff writer for The New Yorker since 1998. Terry spoke to Spector earlier this week.
Michael Spector, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, you write that 13 journalists have been killed in Russia since 1999. Can you go through this morbid roll call of which journalists were killed and what was done to them?
13 journalists have been killed since Vladimir Putin became president. They share a couple chilling characteristics. One is ugly deaths, and the other notable one is that they were opponents of the Kremlin. Different people were shot. One man who I knew fairly well, Yuri Shikachikin, who worked at Novaya Gazeta along with Anna Politkovskaya, who was also killed recently and who I wrote about in last week's issue of the magazine, died mysteriously while he was investigating nefarious connections between the FSB, which is the Federal Security Agency, the successor to the KGB, and mafia and government. He died. Doctors said he died of an allergic reaction, though they could never say to what. And his family is convinced that he was poisoned in the manner of Alexander Litvinenko, who was not a journalist, but he was a former FSB agent who was murdered through radiological assassination in London in November.
Yeah, you described the Litvinenko murder as the first known case of nuclear terrorism perpetrated against an individual. Nuclear terrorism because he was killed with polonium-210, which is a rare radioactive isotope. What are the theories in Russia about who is behind these murders and what the motivation is?
Well, there isn't enough time in this show or in our lifetimes to go through every theory because there are thousands of them. Here are some facts. Alexander Litvinenko was an extremely outspoken opponent of Vladimir Putin. He was asked to kill Putin's most famous opponent, Boris Berezovsky, 7 years ago and instead defected to London, became a member of the Berezovsky camp, has said that Putin was responsible for starting the Second Chechen War, which began when a bunch of buildings in Moscow blew up, killing 300 or more people, and which the government blamed on Chechen separatists without any real evidence whatsoever. Litvinenko was poisoned, and there seems to be very little doubt that it would have required a sophisticated organization to bring an isotope of polonium, which is rare and which is almost exclusively manufactured in Russia, into London, slip it into a drink so that he could die. It's an unusual poison because if you touch it, you won't get sick. You have to ingest it. But if you ingest even a microgram, you'll die, and you'll die a very ugly way.
Well, a law was passed by the Russian parliament, the Duma, that permits the assassination of, quote, enemies of the Russian regime abroad. Is it believed in Russia that Litvinenko is a victim of this law?
It's certainly believed by many people, and I guess I would have to say I would be one of those people. As you asked in your last question, there are many theories. There are theories that Putin's opponents had him killed to make Putin look bad, that Putin personally had him killed because he hated him. I can't personally believe, though I will never know, nor will I think anyone know, that the president of Russia actually had him killed. But I do think there's an atmosphere where you can go out and kill people who you oppose and know that you're not going to get prosecuted. And part of that problem is that last year, the Duma passed a law at the president's behest, which basically said, if there's an enemy of the Russian regime abroad, we can kill him. And if you kill him, it'll be fine. And It just seems somewhat tailor-made to kill people like Alexander Litvinenko, though definition of enemy of Russian regime is a rather vague term these days.
And I find abroad a little vague, too. Does it mean like a foreigner who's an enemy of the regime or a Russian who has gone to another country to visit or to live? Are they an enemy abroad?
Well, this is like asking how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. I believe most people felt that the meaning of it was Russian defectors, people like Litvinenko, who had turned against the country. But it isn't legally the case that it means that, and it could mean anyone that opposes the government. In terms of the law, I mean, you know, I don't believe that any country can pass a law saying it's okay to kill other people's citizens, but that basically is what it says.
Has there been any attempt to investigate the murders of journalists or of political or business people who were believed to have been murdered by the state?
Yes, there have been attempts. They don't seem to be very wholehearted, and the reason I say that is because of the 13 journalists who died in the last 7 years. There have been zero convictions, and almost no one has been apprehended yet. And in the rare cases where people were apprehended, the trial was a mistrial, or it was very clear that they were low-level people. Paul Klebnikov is an American who was the founding editor of the Russian edition of Forbes. He was gunned down outside his office. His murderers are still at large. And I actually do believe the Russian government is somewhat forcefully trying to prosecute that, but they're not having a lot of luck. And again, I think part of it is even when they want to, there is an atmosphere there where, you know, go kill people. It's okay. And people shoot people in the head there and walk away, and people see it, and they're not reported. Anna Politkovskaya, who was the most famous journalist and the one who died on October 7th, was shot in her elevator four times on a Saturday afternoon, the last time just inches away from her head. They call this in Russian kontrolny vystrel, which means control shot. It's a totally common term in Moscow. Everyone knows it. Housewives know it. When normal people know that term, it's not really a good thing for your society.
Now, as you've pointed out, you know, there have been 13 journalists who have been murdered in Russia since 1999 when Putin became the president. So how has the press been covering the murder of journalists?
The press has changed dramatically, and their ability to cover events has been altered quite a bit. When I lived in Russia, which was in 1994 through 1998, there were many problems, but the press was vibrant and vigorous and did what it thought it ought to do, sometimes for better or worse. But there were lots of voices, and one sort of felt that people could go out and try and find out the truth. These days, it's much more complicated. You're allowed to write what you want, as long as you write it for a newspaper that nobody reads. Most people see TV, and that's all they see. TV is totally either completely owned by the Kremlin or owned by organizations, political organizations, or most importantly, businesses like the giant gas and oil concerns, Gazprom and Rosneft, who are basically arms of the state. So TV is so tightly controlled, and 95% of information people get is from TV, that all these other investigations are somewhat meaningless. You know, it is the case that you can go onto the internet and people write what they want and see what they want, and I don't believe there's censorship there at all. It's also the case that very few people, once you get outside of Moscow and St. Petersburg, and even in those cities, either have access to or really get their information from the internet.
Can you describe how the TV networks became owned by the state or by companies that function, as you describe it, as corporate arms of the state?
Yes, I can. And when I was there, the first Chechen War started about when I got there and lasted almost 2 years. And it was a bloody war, and the Russians knew that it was a bloody war because they saw it every night, particularly on a station called NTV, which stands for Independent Television Network, which was owned by one of the very rich Russian so-called oligarchs named Vladimir Guzinski and run by a man named Igor Malashenko. And it was sort of like in America during the time of Vietnam. I mean, people were shocked. They turned on their TV at night and they saw their kids getting killed, and they saw a city being destroyed, a countryside being laid waste. And it very quickly turned the Russian people against that war and against the president, President Yeltsin, whose popularity plummeted dramatically, in part, large part because of that and also because of economic chaos that reigned. Vladimir Putin wasn't about to let that happen. And when he became president, he made sure that these major networks were owned either by companies, they just bought them. In the case of NTV, it's almost like The Godfather. They just made an offer you couldn't refuse, and if you did refuse it, they upped the offer, and if you refused that, then you were prosecuted and hounded out of the country. Vladimir Grudzinski now lives in Israel. I don't think that he would last 1 hour on the street in Moscow if he were to return.
The state-controlled energy company Gazprom took over the TV station NTV in the middle of a broadcast. Would you describe what happened?
Well, they took it over. They bought it. They so-called bought it. It's not the type of purchase that we consider a normal purchase where people offer fair market value and buy things. But they got it. And then they just said, we're going to change things. And a man named Andrei Norkin, who is an extremely brave and intelligent broadcaster, was on the air trying to explain to his viewers, of which there were still millions, what was going on. And they simply cut him off. They just cut them off. It was like the old Russian Soviet days. The television went to test patterns, and Norkin and his gang were out. And, you know, within an hour or two, a bunch of people speaking pablum were given the news.
New Yorker staff writer Michael Spector speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with journalist Michael Spector. His piece about the death of opponents of Russian President Vladimir Putin appears in The New Yorker.
Before the state basically took over control of the TV networks in Russia, they were owned by the new oligarchs, the really wealthy people who prospered after the collapse of communism. You write a little bit about journalism, what journalism on television was like then. And you write about how some of the journalists, after a while, were so concerned that there was going to be a return to communism or to neo-communism that the journalists started taking sides and even slanting the news. What are some examples of that?
Well, there's one particular example. It's a very major example, and it changed Russia in a significant and maybe very depressing way. Boris Yeltsin, as I said earlier in this conversation, had become extremely unpopular by 1996 when he was running for re-election. He was running against a guy named Gennady Zyuganov, who was the head of the Communist Party, and he was a hardcore old-line communist. And a lot of young Russians really felt they had gotten rid of communism, it was dead forever, it was never going to come back. And here was Zyuganov saying, hey, this guy's a joke. The economy is terrible. Sort of what Ronald Reagan said when he ran, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And what Bill Clinton ran on, it's the economy, stupid. This is what people care about in the world, not just in Russia or the U.S. And things were terrible. There was chaos. There was fear. There was also the sense that a great, powerful nation had been humiliated in almost unspeakable ways and become meaningless. Zyuganov played into this, and people in the liberal world, in the press world, in the world that had a stake in the new economy, some of them for worse, but a lot of them for better, said, gee, I don't want to go back to collective life. And the people who owned those networks and newspapers basically decided, hey, we're going to reelect Yeltsin. He had about 3% popularity at the time, and they pumped him up to 54% just by accentuating the positive and trashing Zyuganov like you can't believe. And the press basically, including my friends, including really good, honorable people, went along with it. They hadn't had a history of thinking about these things. And all they really knew was they didn't want communism coming back. And that was the worst thing that could happen to Russia. And they were going to stop it no matter what. And so they did.
Do you think that in any way that opened the door to the manipulation of the press now?
Yes. I think that Vladimir Putin and his people are very clever and smart. And they watched this happen. And what they took away from this was a very important lesson, which is the press is powerful. And you can use the press to manipulate voter opinions, the way people think about issues. You can bring a man down. You can destroy a company. You can turn people against a policy, a nation, if you get out there and shove it down 95% of the people's throats. And that's what happened. And they were able to do that because they were very sophisticated, and they also saw that in 1996, hey, these guys actually turned the election around. These guys have some power. Let's use it.
You mentioned that although freedoms are limited now in Russia, people are living better than they have in a long time. You know, the economy has improved, and that has a lot to do with oil. How is oil affecting Russia now?
How isn't it? Russia is basically a cold version of Saudi Arabia at this point. It exports something like 30% of the world's oil and gas. That number could go up. We live in a world now where the Mideast is a mess, where you can't rely on the oil, where we're trying to cut down, or one would like to think we're trying to cut down on what the president of our country eventually and finally called our addiction to oil. And Russia has it, and we need it. And the price of oil when Vladimir Putin assumed office was something like $19 a barrel. It fluctuated. It got up to 70. It's down around 55 or 52 now. That money goes right into the coffers of the Russian government. When he took over, all the time that I lived in Russia, the Russian government spent all its time trying to raise enough money to feed its people, to run its programs. It used to have to go to the International Monetary Fund all the time to ask permission for things. Now they have just tons of money. They don't ask permission, nor should they, nor do they need to, for anything they want to do. They have all the money in the world. And they've gone from being a debtor, beggar, humiliated country to an extremely rich, powerful, and politically potent one, and it's all because of oil. And oil prices do fluctuate. When the price of oil dropped in the 80s, it's pretty clear that it was one of the things that led to the destruction of the Soviet Union, because they didn't have a plan B, and either does Russia right now.
So who's benefiting from the oil? Like, who's financially benefiting from it?
To be honest, the entire country to some degree. A bunch of people are getting obscenely rich, but that was true under Boris Yeltsin. What is also happening is that people are living better. Average people, middle-class people, pensioners, retired people, sick people are getting better benefits. It's really remarkable. If you go to Moscow today, it's not just the case that there's a bunch of shockingly rich people, but it's also the case that working people are taking vacations and sending their kids to schools and taking better care of their parents and buying clothing from fancy stores and living like we consider ourselves to live in the West.
Putin is supposed to step down next year. Is it likely that he will?
That's like asking the question of who killed Alexander Litvinenko. There are 27,000 scenarios. I'll go out on a limb and say, sure, I think he will step down. I don't think he wants to be seen as Idi Amin. But stepping down, they're stepping down and they're stepping down. I don't think he's going to step down, move to a retirement home and play pinochle. What he has said is he intends to, quote, retain influence. He could do that in any number of ways. He could become the prime minister. He could become the chairman of Gazprom, the biggest company. There is a feeling that he may, in fact, just switch jobs with the current chairman, who's his first deputy prime minister. So will he continue as president for a third term? I doubt it very strongly. Will he stop being obvious in decision-making? I don't think that's likely either.
What's the relationship now between Bush and Putin? You know, early in the Bush presidency, he said he looked in Putin's eyes and saw his soul.
I don't pretend to know the answer to that. They seem to get along on a superficial level. Condoleezza Rice has been openly critical of the Kremlin, very supportive of free press. But these are just words. We're not doing anything in this country to try to change Russia's behavior. And by the way, either is Europe. And European companies and European governments want the oil and they want the gas. And that's what they want. And that pretty much governs all relationships.
Well, finally, I'm just wondering if your recent report from Russia, when combined with your experiences when you covered Russia from 94 to 98, have led to any, you know, new reflections about the role of the press in covering, you know, the most important political news of the day.
Well, it's not made me happy. I mean, I think one thing that's really important is that people take away the memory of what Anna Politkovskaya did, not just that she was killed, but that she spent years documenting horrible atrocities in Chechnya when no one else would go, when no one else would write it, at great cost to herself. She was ostracized. There were other attempts on her life. She never gave up because she knew it was honest, it was the truth, and it had to be done. And I think we all have to remember that that's what we do our jobs for. And it's not easy to do it sometimes. It's not easy to be brave when you know that the chances of you dying are high and the chances of you being hated are even higher. But I did take away a sense that the Russian people need to understand that better, and they don't understand it because it's their freedoms just came one day, and they never, you know, if Vladimir Putin never says, gee, from now on you can't travel to England or turn in your passports or you can't go out on Friday night, they'll have a different idea about freedom of speech. But right now that hasn't happened, and living better and seeing your kids happier and in a better school and in a warmer coat trumps an idea. And that I understand, but it's sad.
Michael Spector, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Journalist Michael Spector speaking with Terry Gross. His piece about murders of the opponents of Russian President Vladimir Putin appears in The New Yorker. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Sight Unseen, a novel of psychological suspense set in Britain by Robert Goddard. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember liberal political columnist Molly Ivins. In her 40-year career, she skewered politicians in Texas and on the national stage in humorous books and columns. In recent years, her main target was President Bush and the war in Iraq. Ivins died yesterday after an 8-year battle with breast cancer. We'll listen back to two of Terry's interviews with her. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Sacred Games, a new novel about organized crime in India. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The buzz in the literary world at the moment is about a 900-page epic crime novel set in modern-day India. It's called Sacred Games, and its author is Vikram Chandra. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Although it seems as though everybody still wants to write a novel, fewer Americans want to read one, at least serious ones. According to the oft-cited study, Reading at Risk, which was published by the National Endowment for the Arts in 2004, the number of Americans who read literary fiction for pleasure is fast approaching the number of adults who opt for elective tracheotomies. That's my nightmare take on the future of literature on especially glum days. But then along comes a bold, fresh, and big, really big, novel like Vikram Chandra's Sacred Games, and all those pessimistic predictions vanish. Sacred Games is a 900-page novel about contemporary India that comes complete with a selected glossary of terms for us non-Indian readers, as well as with a helpful reminder list at the beginning of the book of who's who among the many major characters, such as you usually find in the front of a novel by Tolstoy or Agatha Christie. That odd couple comparison is apt because Sacred Games has the sweep and social commentary of the great 19th century epic novels, yet it also toys with a crime fiction plot. It cheers me up that in this age of waning attention spans and apparently waning interest in literature, Chandra didn't take the safer route and say, produce a slim work of fiction about relationships. Instead, he's gone ahead and written a doorstopper of a challenging urban novel. And best of all, not only does Sacred Games deserve praise for its ambitions, but also for its terrific achievement. Maybe literature as a pastime is sinking under the tide of technology. If so, Sacred Games, given its size and buoyancy, makes an excellent life raft for those folks determined to hold on to the pleasures of sustained reading. In brief, Sacred Games tells the intertwined stories of Inspector Sartaj Singh, who's set apart because he's a lone Sikh serving on the police force of Mumbai, also known as Bombay, and Ganesh, a Hindu crime lord. In a slapstick confrontation in Chapter 2 of the novel, Sartaj is tipped off that Ganesh is hiding out in a certain factory district of Bombay. When Sartaj arrives at the address, he's stunned to see a building, a solid white windowless cube that we later learn is a nuclear fallout shelter Ganesh had commissioned to be built in a record 10 days. The cube is equipped with a speaker box through which Ganesh, hiding inside, taunts Sartaj. The question is, how are you going to get in? Abruptly after Ganesh issues that challenge, the tone of the scene changes and he fatally shoots himself in the head. How are you going to get in? That question, the windowless cube, of course they're hulking metaphors for the mystery of Ganesh and his odd suicide that Sartaj sets out to solve. Sartaj is in his 40s, divorced, and afflicted, as he admits to himself, with a kida, an Indian word that literally means a worm and figuratively means an inexplicable stubbornness, an obsession. Sartaj's obsession takes him all over Bombay and environs, from Bangladeshi slum neighborhoods to Bollywood penthouses. The tales within tales here carry us readers back into India's recent history and take us into detours through the life stories of minor characters like Ganesh's holy man father and the professional street pickpockets who Sartaj questions. The form of this constantly surprising novel also morphs into different shapes. Sometimes it's pared down, action-driven. At other times, the language is meditative. Here, for instance, is a passage where Sartaj's love interest, a woman named Mary, thinks about the violent death of her sister. For a month, she had walked around with a reeling heart, feeling dizzy through the day. Then finally the knowledge had settled in, became part of the structure of the new world. That's how it was when you confronted something impossible. At first there was nausea, a loss of all landmarks. Your own home became a hostile borderland. And then one day you knew that this raw wasteland, this garish alien light, was your home. You just had to have patience and will enough to survive the first terrors. The test of a teeming narrative like this is its end. Unlike the ordered universe of the great 19th century Russian and British novelists, all the storylines here don't converge in one big pleasing click of coincidence. This is modern India, after all, chaotic, beautiful, on the move. Sacred Games ends in many disparate clicks and some deliberately dangling threads. But here's one crucial experience Chandra's novel does offer in common with its sprawling 19th century forebears. When, as a reader, you reach the last page of Sacred Games, you feel as though you've been expelled from a world that, over weeks of reading, has come to feel like a second home.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University, and her memoir, Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading, is now out in paperback. She reviewed Sacred Games by Vikram Chandra. Coming up, we remember liberal columnist Molly Ivins. This is Fresh Air. Molly Ivins, the liberal Texas journalist known for roasting politicians on skewers with plenty of salsa, died in Austin yesterday at the age of 62. She'd battled breast cancer since 1999. Raised in an affluent Houston neighborhood as the daughter of a Republican oil man, Ivins once said most of her strength came from learning how to stand up to her father. In the 1970s, she edited the Texas Observer, a bimonthly muckraking publication that she remained committed to all her life. She went on to work at the New York Times, but returned to Texas in the 1980s and became a syndicated columnist. She was hard on President Bush, often calling him Shrub. He issued a statement yesterday saying he respected Ivins' passion and that her quick wit and commitment to her beliefs will be missed. Molly Ivins wrote 6 books, as well as pieces for Esquire, The Atlantic Monthly, and The Nation. Terry spoke to her in 2003 when her book Bushwhacked was released, 2 years and 10 months into Bush's first term in office.
Now, you're in an interesting position living in Texas and having followed George W. Bush's career as governor of that state. You write about the president's religion, and you say, while you acknowledge that, you know, religion is usually off limits for the press to write about, you think it's important to bring it up in the case of President Bush. Why?
Well, I think that George W. Bush, unlike his father, his dad, George Bush, was clearly a sort of upper-class Eastern WASP. W is really consciously, culturally identified as a Texan. And you see in his character sort of 3 common strands of Texas culture. One is religiosity, anti-intellectualism, and machismo. And all 3 of them are very appealing to broad groups of voters. And I think in Bush's case, at least with the first 2, absolutely genuine. I think the religiosity is genuine, and I think it needs to be looked at, as I say, mostly religion, pretty much, you leave it out of pace. But to the extent that his religious beliefs influence policy, which they do at several intersections, then I think it's legitimate to take a look at it.
Now, in Bushwhacked, you describe the Bush administration as driven by ideology. What do you see as the ideology that drives it?
The ideology of this administration. Bush himself, as a political operator, didn't seem to me, as governor, terribly ideologically motivated. He was on some issues, death penalty, some others you couldn't move him on. But basically, he was, flexible enough to play the game with the powers that then were in the legislature. And I think Bush has always chosen, these older male mentors. And his pick on his way to Washington was Dick Cheney, who is really quite ideological. If you go back, political reporters are great believers in look at the record. If you check Cheney's political record as a voting member of Congress, you'll find it's really quite extraordinary. He was often one of only 1, 2, or a handful of votes opposed to what would normally be considered, the legislative equivalent of voting in favor of a resolution commending motherhood. And I think that part of what has happened is that Washington is such a polarized place. And there genuinely is the people who call themselves movement conservatives, who really genuinely subscribed to the ideology that government is bad, the marketplace will solve all problems, we're much better off, you know, with unfettered capitalism, no government, just let the marketplace solve everything. And that I think that's almost like a religious belief rather than a political belief. It seems to be an article of faith with many of these people. Undeterred by reality, experience, the record, or anything else. And so it seems to me that Bush has actually become more ideological since he's gone to Washington, particularly to the extent that he, and this is a really elementary political mistake, I can't believe Karl Rove, who's a very smart guy, is really letting this happen. It seems to me the mistake is that they're only listening to one another, that there is a sort of loop of insiders, and I mentioned Rumsfeld and Cheney and all that circle of people. They're just talking to each other, and they're not hearing from anyone outside the circle, which is always a fatal mistake.
Molly Ivins speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. Ivins died yesterday at the age of 62. Her first interview on Fresh Air was in 1991, when her book, Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She?, was published. She began with a reading from the book.
In my youth, I aspired to be a great journalist. George Orwell, Albert Camus, and I.F. Stone were my heroes, great writers and intellectuals who helped illuminate their times. But look, God gave those guys fascism, communism, colonialism, and McCarthyism to struggle against. All I got was Lubbock. It's not my fault.
do you still feel like you didn't get the big stories to cover?
I'm afraid so, although I must say there's enough real about the great state of Texas to keep anybody busy.
Well, it seems to me what your stories have turned out to be is Texas, women, and general overall stupidity in politics.
I've been writing about Texas politics for a long time, and that will give a person plenty of material.
You've written that as a lifelong Texas liberal, you've spent your whole life, your whole of your existence, in a political climate to the right of Ronald Reagan. You're, in fact, from a family who was very right-wing. What was right-wing about them?
Well, my daddy was John Connally's campaign manager. I guess that qualifies.
All right.
I have to say, my daddy and I don't agree on much politically. In fact, it's true. I've about the political climate of Texas and what I think of as most of the real world. I define the real world as just about every place outside Manhattan Island. It has always sort of amazed and amused me that so many of these right-wing intellectuals that they call the neoconservatives seem to be operating under the bizarre impression that the world is actually run by people of the liberal persuasion. A notion I find so comical that I'm barely able to talk politics with those folks.
What got you questioning the conservative worldview that your family had?
Well, I think all Southern liberals come from the same starting point, which is race. I grew up in the South before the Civil Rights Movement, and it was an era when all grown-ups lied. If you lived in the white part of town and you'd go to the drinking fountains, they'd say, "Now, don't drink out of that fountain, dear. That's dirty." That was the one that said colored on it. Well, of course, you lived in the white part of town, and kids had been crawling all over the white fountain all day. It was full of bubble gum and dirty grease marks and stuff. And you knew that the colored fountain wasn't dirty. There was something they weren't telling you. And you know how horribly logical little children can be. You just start picking up on those clues early on, and somehow I never got over it. The first great political question when I was coming up was civil rights, and I was in favor of it. And the second great political question to come along was the war in Vietnam, and I was against it. So people told me that meant I was some kind of double-dyed, full-blooded liberal. I said, okay, what did I know? Later on, people took to claiming that it meant I was in favor of big government and communism and high taxes. And that's when I figured out that I should never let anybody else define my politics.
Was your family prosperous? Were you a debutante? Did you have a coming-out party?
No, I was not myself a debutante, but I went to debutante parties. I suppose to some extent did grow up in rather a privileged world. I went to a private school in Houston, Texas, and later went on to Smith College and Columbia University. The flavor of my political opinions, I think, comes not from... In part, I think I grew up different from other girls of my background simply because I read a great deal. And I suppose there was an additional factor. I'm almost 6 feet tall, which makes it hard to be a sweet, dainty, pretty, feminine, little, sweet, proper Southern belle. I mean, they made me captain of the basketball team when I was four, and that sort of went like that.
When did you start writing about the legislature, the Texas legislature, and what was your early response to it?
My first session was in 1971, and I walked onto the floor of the Texas House of Representatives, and it looked sort of like the first day of school. There were 150 men all slapping each other on the back and patting each other on the butt and meeting and greeting and carrying on, and I saw one old boy dig another old boy in the ribs with his elbow and say, "Hey, fella, you should see what I found myself last night, and she don't talk neither." And the two of them went off chortling and snuckling. And I just thought to myself, you know, this is fabulous. It makes some people kind of sick, but very from the beginning, I just thought, this is reporter heaven. This is too funny to be believed, and I've been writing about it that way ever since.
It's good that you were able to keep your bearings and think that you were sane and they were crazy. Not everybody thrown into such a situation would be able to maintain their bearings.
Oh, if you had ever witnessed that collection of geeks and dorks and bozos we have in the state legislature of Texas, I don't think you'd have much trouble.
Do you think that the Texas legislature is any worse than any other state?
Certainly, we're number one bad, and I'll fight to the death with anybody who says we're not. Actually, I do have to tell you, of course, there's great politics over our neighboring state of Louisiana. And in a political storytelling contest, I often get a run for my money with folks from New Jersey and Illinois. But I have been in political storytelling contests all over this country with my fellow political writers, and I've never lost one. All I have to do is keep telling true stories about the Texas legislature, and sooner or later they all give up and say uncle.
Can you tell one of your favorites for us?
Well, there's so many it's hard to say, but perhaps my all-time favorite Texas representative was Mike Martin from Longview. He was an early harbinger of the moral majority. Got elected on a platform of being pro-family and pro-American, but frankly, if you'd put that man's brain in a bumblebee, it would have flown backwards. He could not get a single bill passed, not even memorial resolutions for people in his district who had died. So when it came time for re-election, of course, kind of hard to get re-elected if you hadn't done anything. Looked bad for Mike's re-election chances, but he came up with an innovative scheme. He paid his cousin Charlie to shoot him in the arm with a shotgun. Then he claimed it had been done by a satanic and communistic cult. And here were the law enforcement people running all over Texas trying to find some satanic communistic cult, which is fairly hard to do. And there was great uproar in the press about it, and everybody running around thinking people, the lives of legislators were in danger, and nobody knew what to think about it. Well, the plot came unraveled. Charlie had too much beer, as I recall, in a bar one night and spilled the beans. And I always point out, only the Texas legislature would have had the foresight to make it illegal to pay someone to shoot you. It is illegal in our state, so don't come down and do it, Terry. And with that, Mike Martin became a wanted man. But instead of facing up to his then legal difficulties, Mike Martin took it on the lam. He went underground. He went into hiding. And we had to send the Texas Rangers after him. They hunted him high, hunted him low. Took him 2 weeks to track Martin to earth. He was hidden at his mother's house outside Longview. And they actually found him hiding in the stereo cabinet. Now, many people have asked me what Martin was doing in that stereo cabinet. I'm here to tell you that man always did want to be a speaker.
Molly Ivins speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We're listening to Terry's 1991 conversation with liberal Texas journalist Molly Ivins, who died yesterday.
The title of your new book, Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She?, comes from an actual story. Would you tell the story?
When I first started writing a column for the Dallas Times-Herald back in 1982, I found Dallas, Texas to be really quite a buttoned-up sort of town, really very proper. And they were not used to someone with my kind of freewheeling style. And I reviewed the performance of a local congressman. He was Republican from North Dallas, and took a look at what he'd done lately, and it caused me to render the judgment that if that man's IQ slipped any lower, we'd have to water him twice a day. Well, that, good heavens, touched off all kinds of outraged protest from Republicans around there, and they all threatened to cancel their subscriptions and start advertiser boycotts and such, and my paper did kind of a gutsy thing. They took out billboards all over Dallas, Texas, that said, Molly Ivins can't say that, can she?
And what effect did that advertising campaign have? How did it go over?
Well, it's been real interesting. Every year they do polls to see who is the best liked and most hated columnist in Dallas, and I'm always both of them. So we figure that means people are reading it.
That's great. Now, is it right that the New York Times fired you for describing a community chicken-killing festival as a gang pluck?
That comes close to the truth. I actually,
how close?
I resigned from the Times, but I was not in good smell with the powers that be, and it was over the time I tried to call that community chicken killing a gang pluck. They felt that was conduct unbecoming a New York Times reporter.
And how did they let you know that?
Oh, I had this hilarious interview with Abe Rosenthal, then the executive editor of the Times. I had been Rocky Mountain bureau chief for the New York Times for 3 years, covered 9 mountain states out in from the Canadian to the Mexican border. It was a wonderful assignment. And that's where I wrote the story about the community chicken slaughter. And when I got back to New York, I was abruptly recalled, kind of like a defective automobile. Abe hauled me into his office, and we kind of went around about whether or not I was deliberately trying to stick my thumb in the eye of the New York Times, as I recall his words, and I explained that, no, I never tried to do that, actually. I just never understood where they drew the line at the Times, and when it was pointed out to me, my honest reaction was always, you've got to be kidding. So we argued that up and down a bit, and then he said, in an accusatory tone, you tried to call that community chicken killing a gang pluck. I said, yes, Abe, I did. He said, gang pluck. I said, well, Abe, I thought it was a good line. He said, gang pluck. I said, hey, well, Abe, it's a play on words. He said, gang pluck. You were trying, that is a play on gang f-. You were trying to make our readers think of the word f-. I said, damn, Abe, you are a hard man to fool.
I'm wondering, you know, some people from Texas end up telling stories about their state and everything. Do you think that some people camp it up a little bit when telling colorful stories about the South?
Yes and no. There's a genre of person that we refer to somewhat scornfully as professional Texans. I must say sometimes I feel in danger of becoming a professional Texan myself. And people who, you know, have lived up here in the North and who dine out on old stories for many years, eventually becoming terrible bores to everyone, including themselves. There is an almost irresistible tendency to play Texan, however. I remember when I first joined the Times, the editors were taking me around and they'd introduce me to someone and say, this is Molly Ivins, she just joined the paper, she's from Texas. And people would look up very expectantly and say, oh, from Texas? And I found myself sticking out my hand and saying, howdy. You know, I just didn't want to let anybody down.
Right.
And there is an extent to which you play the role, particularly if you're a Texan in the North, because people expect it of you and enjoy it. And sometimes I feel when I'm in the North as though I speak two languages and they only speak one.
But you speak North and South?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In Texas circles, do you ever end up at parties with some of the politicians who you cover?
Yes, I do. I have always been something of an outsider journalist because my political opinions aren't popular in my home state. But yes, I have over the years socialized with Texas politicians.
Does that make it harder to say what you want to say about them?
Not for me.
Do you ever learn anything that gives you insights into their character or politics from the parties?
I'm trying to think. Yes, I suppose so. Although, as a journalist, stuff that you learn that you can't use really isn't that much use to you.
I bet you see a lot of stuff that you can't use at those parties.
Yeah, but I love to make fun of politicians, and as far as I'm concerned, they're all in a free fire zone. But I do have some respect for their privacy. Even the dimmest of them actually devote a fair number of hours to public service, and I think they deserve some respect for their privacy.
Molly Ivins, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
All right, it was my pleasure.
Molly Ivins speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. Ivins died in Austin yesterday at the age of 62. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Fairbee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Pardon me, stranger. I hope there's no danger. You'll think I'm getting all of my range.
Go ahead, partner. It's all
right.
Oh,
but I calculate.
What's that?
That you're from my state.
Yes.
And though you may think it's strange.
Don't go over this chew tobacco I've got.
I allow as how you're from Texas.
Right,
you talk
it.
The lingo I understand.
Yes.
I'll bet my kale that you hail from Texas.
Oh.
There's no mistake in the brand.
Uh-huh.
You've got a smile like an acre of sunflower.
Oh, acre?
Your eyes are a blue bun in blue. Shake hands, it's grand that you're from Texas. 'Cause I'm from Texas.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble. With the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Harriet Jacobs's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching, at breakthroughcollaborative.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
At this year's Academy Awards, legendary Italian film score composer Ennio Morricone will receive an honorary award. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear about Morricone from film historian Christopher Frayling. Also, Peter O'Toole. He's nominated for an Oscar for his starring role in the film Venus. Join us for the next Fresh Air.